Welcome to the Journalism of Everything podcast. I am your host, Doree Smith, a freelance journalist bringing you curiosity, research, and expert interviews with thoughtfulness. The easiest thing you can do is stay informed. Enjoy the episode. On November 21st, 1999, 5-year-old Elian Gonzalez boarded a small aluminum boat with a bad motor with his mother, Elizabeth Brotons Rodriguez, and 12 others. And they were headed from Cuba to the United States, which is about 90 miles. They hit a storm, and the boat capsized despite everyone trying to bail out the water out of the boat. Elizabeth placed Elian into an inner tube that she brought just in case, and this saved his life. But Elizabeth and her boyfriend died. Elian and 2 others survived. Now, Elian's mother and father had been divorced before his birth, and generally, they shared custody while they were in Cuba. Now, Elian's mother snuck Elian into that boat and headed to the U.S. without his dad, Juan Miguel, knowing. Immigration and Naturalization Service, which was INS at the time, and now is actually several agencies, including ICE, or Immigration and Customs Enforcement. These are all under the Department of Homeland Security. But at the time, INS released Elian to his paternal great uncle who lived in the United States in Miami. From then on, a blazing custody and immigration dispute ensued. And if you were alive and aware at the time, you know about this case. It was in the news every single day for months. The U.S. and Cuban governments were going back and forth on who should get custody of Elian from November 1999 to April 22, 2000. Elian's status was debated. Does he fall under the wet foot, dry foot policy, where Cuban immigrants who made it to U.S. soil were automatically granted asylum, or where if they were intercepted at sea, they were returned to Cuba? Will Elian benefit most from being raised a United States or a Cuban citizen, and who decides that? The Clinton administration and most federal courts agreed that Elian should be returned to his father in Cuba. Several times, Janet Reno, who was the attorney general at the time, she ordered that Elian be returned to his father, but Elian's U.S. relatives refused to hand him over because they believed he was better off living and being raised in the United States. On Saturday, April 22nd of 2000, there is a picture that actually won the Pulitzer, and that everyone around living around that time knows this picture. It is a terrified Elian Gonzalez screaming and crying. He's in the arms of a man, and an INS agent is in full battle rattle, full riot gear, points an AR-15 in the little boy's face. Now, according to official documents, agents of the United States Border Patrol's BORTAC unit knocked on the door and identified themselves But Elian's family did not answer. And there were actually protesters outside of the house and news and everything. So everyone knew something was going to happen, but they weren't sure when. So apparently they entered the house and they basically maced anyone inside or outside that was trying to interfere with them getting Elian. They ransacked the house looking for him and eventually found him in a back room with Donata Dalrymple, who was actually one of the men rescued with Elian from the sea. Elian was returned to his father in D.C., where there were lots of happy photo ops, of course, and he was raised with his father in Cuba. Elian is now 31 years old, which is hard to imagine. He has a degree in industrial engineering from the University of Matanzas and was elected in April 2023 to the Cuban parliament. You can imagine that he was used by the Cuban politicians as, what's a good way to say this? He was used. He was supported very well and used for the Communist Party. Now, after this raid, which had this horrible picture that was all over the world and all kinds of drama, after this raid, both sides of the aisle exploited this, and they used very strong language and imagery to their political advantage. Since this was under the Clinton administration and this was kind of their call, they relied on the reunion photos with the father. You know, happy reunion, look, we've returned this child to his father, all is well. Whereas on the other side, the Republicans had a lot of very strong language against how this happened. Against the raid. Jesse Helms, he was a Republican senator from North Carolina. I think he lived to be over 100. At the time, he called the photo a grotesque image of the seizure at gunpoint. Tom DeLay was a Republican congressman at the time, called the agents who raided the house jackbooted thugs. And then Republican Congressman Lincoln Diaz-Balart of Florida called the raid an Orwellian monstrosity. Language and images are vital to how we talk about immigration. And politicians, or anyone with a strong opinion for or against immigrants, leverage language to further their point. I spoke to Rekha Sharma Crawford, an immigration attorney based out of Kansas City, Missouri, about the current level of ICE raids, or as she prefers, ICE targeted enforcements, and what legal recourse immigrants have, if any, if they're arrested or deported. Immigration isn't really just an issue of whether or not someone is a criminal, but rather is also a labor and humanitarian issue. Rekha is a partner in the Sharma Crawford Law Firm, and they specialize in aggressively defending the rights of non-citizens. She has been an adjunct professor teaching immigration law at the University of Kansas, as well as Washburn University School of Law. She has spoken several times at national conferences for the AILA, or the American Immigration Lawyers Association. And in 2024, Rekha was elected to the AILA's Executive Committee as treasurer, having also completed her term as secretary from 2023 to 2024. She has earned several awards for her work in immigration law and for her work in advocating for her clients. We had a great discussion. We talked about the ICE targeted enforcement and what's going on with that, but also generally about what happens when immigrants are arrested. What process are they, you know, what are they kind of due to have, or what rights do they have, if any, and just how the court proceedings go, but also the greater issue of immigration being an issue of labor. And I just really enjoy talking to her. And if your ears have really been in tune to what's going on in immigration, of course, since President Trump took office, but also honestly for the decades prior to this, then I think you'll really enjoy this episode. So enjoy, and I can't wait to hear from my listeners what you think. Let's kind of start with just if you could introduce yourself, who you are, and then, you know, I know you have loads of qualifications, if you could cover that.
Well, my name is Rekha Sharma Crawford, and I am an immigration attorney here in Kansas City, Missouri.
Great. And you've written, I know you've got two children's books and you're working on one more. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. You don't think of immigration attorney and children's books in the same sentence. It very rarely comes up like that. But the reality of it is my books are geared towards educating children about things that are immigration related. So my first book, Aliyah the Brave, I wrote because I realized that many immigrant parents, teachers and counselors, nobody had resources to talk to children about what happens when there is an ICE enforcement action inside someone's home. And, you know, these are kids, and we always say that, you know, they're scared of the boogeyman, but what do you do when the boogeyman shows up at your door? And yeah, a lot of folks, there were just no resources available at all for parents and counselors and anybody to talk to children and say, this is what's going on. You know, where to even have those conversations. So that's kind of what brought about that first book. And then the second book, which is Finding Freedom, I wrote after just there was so many media reports about child labor issues that were going on. There was one big child labor story that broke out in Western Kansas. And I realized that there was and you kept seeing in the media and certainly, you know, within the states that there was a rise in child labor bills, you know, saying, oh, we want to lower the age where kids can work and how many hours they can work and what protections they had. And so, you know, that's human trafficking on certain levels. And certainly, you know, where there are certain hallmarks and certain flags that come up with regards to that. Again, it's not just child labor. It becomes human trafficking. But how do you talk to kids about something that heavy, right? Mm-hmm. So I like to joke that I write about really light and happy topics.
Yeah, right.
But my third book actually is, well, it is and it's not. It's actually written and it will be released soon, but it's in conjunction with a nonprofit that I was a board member on called 7 Days. And what it's about is that the founder of 7 Days, Mindy Corcoran, lost her father and her son to horrific hate crime. It was an anti-Semitic man here in Kansas City. Again, under part of, you know, when you have the vitriol and the hate speech, it rises. So this gentleman went out to a Jewish community center and started gunning people down. And the three people actually that were killed were there doing auditions for like a musical theater thing. They weren't even, they're not Jewish. They were just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah.
And Mindy, you know, really could have been buried by that tragedy, but instead rose above it. And so we're writing a book about her whole nonprofit is about simple acts of kindness and how kindness can change so many things. And so this book is literally about that. It's about acts of kindness and her son. So we're looking really forward to releasing that probably in the next month or two.
Oh, wonderful. I know these, all that's been happening since Trump took office, in our house. And of course, I'm doing this research for this episode, we've had a lot of discussions in my house with my 12-year-old son about immigration, and his school is probably 50% Hispanic, yet we're in a very red part of California. And so it's an interesting dynamic, you know, and we've talked about, I know the school district has released things saying we don't even collect, you know, information about someone's status in the country and that sort of thing. But it still, you know, has made him more aware of maybe what some of his friends are going through at home, kind of the worry for themselves, for their family members, you know, that sort of thing. So it's been good. We're trying to take something that I view normally as, or, you know, as negative into something that's an education for him, because that's the reality right now, you know.
Especially with the dissolving of the safe spaces policies, where, you know, previously courthouses and schools and hospitals and things were considered safe spaces, right? People go there for either help, or they're there to address a court issue, or they're in school, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's a logical reason for keeping enforcement activities out of there. You don't see a lot of, you know, law enforcement doesn't go in there. So code enforcement shouldn't have to go in there either. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think you're doing the right thing, because, you know, anymore, kids want to know, and they're so much smarter than we give them credit for.
Yeah.
And they pick up on so many things. And so I think that's kind of where the children's books came from as well, is just to open up these conversations so that you know, they feel a little more empowered and a little less victimized. And they can, you know, you'd be surprised how many kids will say, you know, will stand up for their friends and say, this isn't okay, you know? So yeah. I think you're doing the right thing in that, for sure.
Yeah, I hope so. Want to raise a kind human being. Well, since you brought up the safe spaces, you know, so it's what churches, hospitals, and schools, now they say that ICE can come in.
And courthouses,
yeah.
Courthouses.
Now, do these places have any legal recourse to say, no, you know, you're not coming in, or is it out of their hands?
I mean, I think the issue is going to be, they can say, I mean, the big thing right now that people need to understand is, you know, they don't, when ICE is code enforcement. And I always say that because it's not, they don't go through the same kind of law enforcement training that a police officer does. They don't go through the same kind of law enforcement training that even CBP does. Now, CBP is Customs and Border Patrol, that really, you know, is part of Department of Homeland Security, right? So you have the Department of Homeland Security that has basically, you know, you have USCIS, and then you have ICE, and then you have CBP. Now, within ICE, there's a section or a group of individuals that are called Homeland Security Investigations, HSI. Now, those are law enforcement folks, right? They've gone through proper law enforcement training, but your average ICE agent is code enforcement. They're not really law enforcement. And I know they walk around with the big vests that say police and things like it, but there's a reason why they do that. They do that because if they walked around with a vest that said code enforcement, nobody would know what the heck that means, right? And so, yeah. You know, they use some of that nomenclature and some of that, the costume of it, if you will, mm-hmm. Because it gives them legitimacy. And it also, in some ways, gives them protection, because if you've got code enforcement saying stop, they're going to go, who are you? We don't understand. So I mean, but they're not technically under the law. We're not even technically under the law. They're code enforcement.
Huh. Does that mean they can work outside of the law, or does that mean
warrants? Yeah. It means that the warrants that they carry are not judicial warrants.
Oh.
It's not signed off by a judge.
Oh, interesting.
Right. Huh. It's literally them typing something up,
right,
and handing it to you. And so, you know, when you think about the Constitution and you think about certain rights under the Constitution, in particular, the Fourth Amendment against unreasonable searches and seizures, right? They don't have a judicial warrant. So when you say, I want to see a warrant, and they hand you this random piece of paper that they signed to themselves,
right?
I mean, it's not a judicial warrant. And I think, you know, whether it's secure places or safe places or businesses or homes, people have the right to say, can I see the documentation? I think that exercise of people's constitutional rights is perfectly legitimate.
Wow. Yeah, I didn't realize that, because you see them, on TV or in the media wearing the big police jackets and, and coming in by force. And seems like there's so many different types of, police that you don't know where they are kind of in the spectrum of things.
And I'm not trying to demean them, but I'm giving you an
Sure,
example,
sure, sure.
which is code enforcement is the guy that impounds your car. Code enforcement is the guy that says your dog's being too loud. Code enforcement is the guy that says your grass is too high. That's what code enforcement is. Now, can the guy who says your grass is too high come barging into your house? No, right? So then what gives ICE the ability to do that? They don't have that right. And
Oh,
so,
interesting.
I mean, I think they should be treated respectfully. I don't think that people should act crazy with them, but I do think they are well within their rights to say, look, I want to see a warrant. And in fact, there's a great case out of out of California, in fact, that talks about Fourth Amendment rights, where not only is it your house, but your curtilage. And your curtilage, if you think about it, is your lawn. It's basically everything that is your property. You have the right to be secure in your property. It's basic Fourth Amendment protections against unlawful searches and seizures. And so, yeah, you can say, please get off my land.
Interesting.
Unless you have a judicial. Now, the problem is most people are too afraid of authority to say that, right? Nobody's gonna say, I mean, think about that. The example I always give people is even you're driving down the road and you've done nothing wrong and a police car pulls in behind you freak out.
Oh,
I
yeah.
mean, right? Even though you're like, oh my gosh, is am I going too fast? Is everything okay? Right? You freak out. It's natural human reaction. But the reality, so if you're not doing anything wrong and your natural reaction is to panic, if you're a non-citizen and you feel scared anyways, your natural reaction is going to be to panic and you're not going to be able to say, hey, please get off my lawn. But that's why, those cards that people are been handing out and attorneys and advocates have been handing out that say, here are your rights, right? We tell people all the time to say, just keep one with you. You just have to hand it to them because sometimes that's easier than saying, hey, I'm willing to cooperate, but I want to see a judicial warrant or I want to talk to a lawyer.
Yeah, I would imagine if you're undocumented and any police comes or anyone like that comes to your house, you would especially freak out because you're, I don't know, do your clients kind of feel like they're always in this limbo of some sort?
I always say I've never met the client in 25 years of doing this work. I've never met the client who says, I have the ability to find status, but nah, it's okay. I've never met that client. When people say over and over again, why didn't they get legal for all these? And I always say that that question is so reflective of an absolute lack of understanding of how the immigration system works. Because, advocates always say it's broken, but until you've actually walked into the system, you don't realize how really screwed up this is. And we get all the time people will say, wait, we thought I'm married to a citizen. This should be no problem. And we're like, yeah, that doesn't guarantee you anything. Or I have this great worker who's been an excellent employee. How do I fix this? That? Yeah, you don't have an option to do that. And people don't understand that, right? And I think some of the vitriol that comes, I think if people understood how many barriers there are to status and how many roadblocks and how it's just cumbersome and draconian and it's unworkable, if they truly understood that, I think they would have a different level of empathy and compassion for what's going on.
Although sometimes I think it's code for, well, I don't really want them here at all, but I'm gonna say, you have to do it legally.
I mean, bigotry is something that is got a deeper issue than just immigration, right? I
Yeah.
mean, I think that that's a historical issue that I think has deep roots in the United States and probably in a lot of countries there are, that struggle. I mean, immigration is not just a issue that the United States struggles with. I mean, you see it in Europe, you see it in, lots of other places. And so you see it in Canada, right? I mean, so you, this is not a unique thing just to the United States. I think there is a bit of human psychology in play as well, in the sense that I do think that every generation, and when you look back in history, at least in the United States, and like I say, everywhere, I think, when you look at history, there's this weird phenomena that says, I made it, but the next guy shouldn't make it.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't know if it can be traced all the way back to like Darwinism and survival of the fittest. I don't know. I don't know the history of that. And I certainly am the wrong person to answer those questions, but it is an interesting, somewhat disturbing phenomena that you'll see every population that comes forward wants to pull the bridge up behind them. And I think that's what you see is as well, I don't want them here anyways. And I mean,
Right.
you look at certain communities and even within the communities, right? I'm don't even go outside the like basic immigrant communities. You'll have the same kind of thing. Well, I got here, but I don't want them here. And so it's really fascinating in terms of,
Yeah.
but I think there's a deeper psychological, sociological, anthropological study there somewhere that's way outside of my wheelhouse.
Yeah. Maybe I'll do another episode on something like that because I always find that interesting, you know.
Yeah.
Well, so the raids that we're seeing now, we've had, according to the numbers I saw yesterday, 8,000 arrests since January 20th. But he also did this in the first term that he did. Have you seen a difference in how these raids are being conducted now versus back then?
It's interesting. Let's step back for one second, which is the use of the word raid, right? So I almost feel like that is also by design, right? I think some of this language that gets baked into these debates are designed to elicit a very emotional and a very specific emotional response, right? So for example, you hear this person was raided, and that person, instantly the visual or imagery that pops into your head is what? I mean, think about, and I'm probably dating myself, but we all remember the picture of Elian Gonzalez with the gun in the face, right? That is a raid, right? That is what comes up when you think of a raid, guns and blazing and all this. Most of what's happening right now is targeted enforcement. Okay. And targeted enforcement doesn't sound as sexy as a raid, right? It doesn't conjure up the same level of fear. It doesn't conjure up, it's not enough red meat for the base, right? Because if you say, we're doing targeted enforcement, people are gonna go, what the heck is that, right? We're doing raids. Well, wow, that's a really tough guy thing. That's great, right? So I think I would say one of the things that media and certainly independent media should be doing is calling for a correction of the terminology, right? Because I think that has also added to this hysteria that comes out, right? And I think it adds to that. But in terms of what is happening, they're doing targeted enforcement. So what that means is they have a list of people who either have orders of removal because they went through court, went through an appeal process, or they came in on a visitor visa and that visitor visa has expired, whatever that list is, right? And they're going to a house or a business or whatever and saying, hey, we're looking for Joey. Do you have Joey here? And they say, Joey's there. So they arrest Joey. Now, historically, what they wouldn't do is they wouldn't want to know who else is in the room with Joey. They didn't care because they were like, we're here to get Joey. We're going to take Joey and we're going to leave, right? Part of what's happening now is they're going, okay, and this happens from time to time. Again, this is not new. We saw it after 9/11. Same kind of mentality, right? We saw it during the first Trump administration, right? We saw it. I mean, so this is not a new thing. This happens
Right.
from time to time. But what this means is, and what you're really referring to is collaterals. And in ICE parlance, it's, are we taking the collaterals or are we leaving the collaterals, right? And so right now what is happening is they're taking the collaterals, which means if I happen to run, you know, I'm stopped somewhere or I find you somehow and I run across you and you say, I'm undocumented, or I discover that you're undocumented. Previously, you have no criminal history, you're not bothering anyone, you've been here for, you know, years. I don't really have time for that because there's limited resources. That's the difference that's happening right
Okay,
now.
interesting.
Okay. And so the fear that you're seeing in communities right now is because no one feels safe. They know that if they are in the wrong place at the wrong time, no one is safe.
That makes sense. Now they are doing that, but then I was reading a few articles over the past couple of days saying that a lot of people were also being released because they didn't have anywhere to house them. I'm assuming those are mostly the collaterals that are being released, or do we
I
know?
mean, right. But the thing is this, right? That story is buried. That's not as sexy as we did a raid,
Right.
right? So the microphone's going to go to all of these raids are going on. The second part of that story, right? I guess in journalism speak, the under the fold story, right? Is that they are where the person is. Has no criminal history, is entitled to some due process. They're entitled to go before an immigration court. They're entitled to seek relief in front of an immigration court. Then they are issuing them what is called a notice to appear. And a notice to appear is basically a document no different than a traffic ticket, right? That says, you're in the United States. You've either overstayed your visa or you are here without permission. You're entitled to a hearing before an immigration judge. This is, you know, we can ask you to leave, go take it up with the immigration judge and see if you have any relief available. So they're being released either on, you know, some kind of bond or some kind of supervision or some kind of alternative to detention mechanisms like an ankle bracelet or whatever. But they're waiting on court hearings.
Okay. What is the likelihood that they will show up for their court hearings,
A
given the
vast majority of people show up to their court hearings.
okay.
A vast majority.
Okay.
Where there has been this conversation of, well, they don't show up to their court hearings. Well, funny thing is they don't, again, that's the big sound bite.
Right.
But when you look at what has been happening over the years, what you'll find, and this is a very hotly litigated area of immigration law, which is, are they being given the right information and right documents to know where and when to appear for court? Okay, so think about it like this. If you get a traffic ticket, at the bottom of your traffic ticket, it generally will say, you must appear on this date in this courthouse to answer to these charges, right?
So.
The immigration notice to appear has the same thing at the bottom. But for years and years and years, they would put down, ICE would put down time to be determined, date to be determined.
Oh.
Well, then how would I know where to go and when to go?
Right. When is it gonna
Right?
be?
Yeah, when is that going to be? You would think that this very fundamental, very basic idea that if a traffic beat officer can give you a properly issued ticket, then why can't this code enforcement officer do the same, right? And they didn't. And this has now been to the Supreme Court three times.
Oh, wow.
I mean, this is what I'm saying. It is so hotly contested in terms of, so the first time it went to the Supreme Court said, you can't do that. You have to put it in one document. right? So how did they react? They immediately started putting fake dates on them. See, this is the story that no one talks about, right? So some of this, when you say, well, they're not showing up to court, I mean, you kind of set them up to fail, didn't you?
What are they going to do? Camp out at the courthouse,
I
right?
mean, it was it when they were putting the fake dates on there, sometimes they were putting them on that like midnight on a specific day or on Christmas Day. I mean, it was ridiculous. Like you'd like not in any other legitimate court would this fly, right? But this question has been to the US Supreme Court at least 3 times and it's headed back up there. It'll go back at least a couple more times.
And is the Supreme Court like just not ruling on it, or what's,
No, they ruled on them. So this is the thing, right? So the way the Supreme Court works is that they can only answer the question that is brought to them, right? So for example, if you ask them, did I have toast for breakfast? They can answer that question, but they cannot say you had toast and juice. So it's very tailored in the question that's before the Supreme Court. So this is what takes so long is that in these questions, so the way that the question is posed, they ask this question, but they didn't ask this question. So now it's got to go back up to answer the second question. So that's why I repeat after repeat until you finally have an answer to all the questions. But this has been going on since, well, I mean, the law last robustly changed, last comprehensive immigration law change was in 1996.
That was the year I graduated high school.
And imagine all the things you've done in life since.
lot.
Yeah, a lot has happened, right? So, yeah, I mean, that was the last true comprehensive immigration reform. Everything else has been a band-aid approach. And it is why it is so broken. Because, I mean, if you think of a glass that's shattered and you keep, gluing pieces back together, it's still going to leak.
It's still broken.
Still broken.
Really. Sheesh. Well, one question I have for you too is someone who, let's say they have a notice to appear and they have the right time and date and place. Do they have the same right to representation as any other citizen? And what does that look like usually?
So again, immigration, they call it immigration court. I think that's a huge mislabeling. I think they use the word court to give it the appearance of legitimacy. But there are no rules of evidence. So you think of, common things, people who watch TV know they'll go hearsay, objection, hearsay, right? They've all heard it. It's always saying, yeah, that does not apply in immigration court. You can say, my friend's 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 friend told us this, and they'll go, okay. You're like, what the hell? Like, that doesn't make any sense. There's no right to remain silent. There's no, it's a civil proceeding. So you don't have a Fifth Amendment right. Much like that, you don't have the right to court-appointed counsel. So there is a statutory right to obtain counsel, but you must pay for it yourself. Okay? And the way that courts will interpret it is they'll say it is the privilege of being represented. And therefore, if you take too long, well, then we don't care. It's too far to, then we don't care. Then it's on you. So, yeah, so if you remember back during the first Trump administration, they were putting all these kiddos in court. And there's this incredible audio recording of this immigration judge talking about how he has 3-year-olds come into court, but he can explain to a 3-year-old immigration law with just about as much clarity as necessary for that 3-year-old to make a knowledgeable decision.
Oh my gosh.
I mean that it's quite entertaining. In fact, John Oliver did a whole spiel on it, and If for your listeners, just Google immigration court John Oliver and it'll pop up. And he does an excellent job just kind of showing how ridiculously ill prepared the immigration system is for even what should be a due process hearing. And so, yeah, there's no right to counsel. There's no right to counsel, even if you're a child, and you just kind of make your way through.
Wow, that's I can't imagine because it's such a I mean, even just the what I've seen of my dad, in court, so many procedures, so many things, and most of it, if you like, let's say you have committed a crime and you have that right, most of it is for a reason, like.
Okay, think about it like this. Could you imagine going into a normal real courtroom? And I know your dad's a judge, right? And so, imagine your dad having a whole trial where they don't bring the police officer in, they just say, here's the police report. I mean, it happens all the time. 100%. They'll be like, well, this person was arrested for this crime. Well, any criminal defense attorney will tell you, even law enforcement will tell you that those police reports are not 100%. The reliability of them is not 100%, right? That's why you don't enter them into evidence. You make the officer come testify subject to direct and cross, right? Circuit courts have also said, there's a level of unreliability in just a police report because, they're not designed to be the conviction record. They're designed to just kind of be the notes for the officer. But you would be surprised how many times just the police report comes in immigration court and judges make decisions solely based on that.
Wow, that's
It's screwed
just
up. It's screwed
it's
up.
it is it is it really is. And then you're undocumented and you have or you're in a court that you don't understand and doesn't have the same rules of procedure, it's and you don't aren't necessarily entitled to representation. That's yeah, you're definitely set up for failure
You're
there.
set up for failure. And that's the thing is I always like to say that when the might and power of the United States, who holds all the cards, cheats, there's something really unethical and immoral about that. And I'm a former prosecutor and I used to take that job very seriously. Like I took it to say, we do it right because in the end, you hold all the power, right? And so, if you're going to be given that kind of responsibility, then you also have a greater responsibility to make sure that you're doing it correctly, right? And generally, all through the land, in any normal court that is a real court and a legitimate court, prosecutors and government lawyers are held to a higher standard, as they should be, right? I used to say to juries all the time, is that it was my burden, and I welcomed the burden because I was given enormous power. And with that power came responsibility. And unfortunately, in the immigration system, you don't see that. The vast majority of the system cuts corners, they do things sloppily. I mean, there's no court reporter, it's an audio tape.
Oh gosh.
Yeah. I mean, these are not normal things, these are not ways that we as citizens and as average people think of what we think of in terms of due process and constitutional rights and a fair hearing. I mean, those are very sacred things. So certainly for a lawyer, it's a very sacred thing, right? And so to watch that just being trampled upon in immigration courts across the nation, that's why I say they use the word court for a very specific reason. But the word immigration court does not appear in the law. It's not in the statute. It's in the regulations, but it's not in the statute.
Oh, what does it say?
Immigration hearings.
Hearings.
I mean, Jeff Sessions, it's really fascinating, but Jeff Sessions, in fact, in one of his tirades, referred to immigration judges as low-level United States attorneys.
Wow.
It's out there. That's not
Yeah.
even making it up. That's Sessions calling his own people low-level AUSAs.
Oh, wow. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I had no idea. I hear court. I think of a very certain thing, so they don't really have legal recourse. They do, but but it's stacked again, way against them, sounds. Yeah.
It's a hard mountain to climb. So that's what I'm saying, right? Why don't they get legal?
Yeah.
Come walk with me. I will
Yeah.
tell you why
Right.
they don't get legal.
Let's talk.
Let's talk, right? And I mean, I tell people all the time is, these court hearings for the most part are open, but these courts are, hidden away and people don't know where they are. It's not like they have big signs that say, like when you go down to the federal district court or the state court, there's this huge sign that says, here's the court.
Yeah.
Here in Kansas City, our court is located in an office building. You don't
Really?
know it's there unless you know it's there.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I think of usually it's a very pretty building, right?
It's on the fifth floor of an office building.
Huh. Wow. Yeah,
And
it's
if you don't
amazing.
know it's there, you know
Right.
it's there.
You're not going to find it. Yeah. I say it's amazing, but not in a good way. Well, this kind of goes to what the administration has said, Trump administration has said recently, according to his press secretary, Caroline Leavitt. She says, if you're in the country illegally, then you are considered a criminal. And that's kind of how they're going in to get the collateral people. But then I've read, and I think you kind of alluded to it, that it's not a crime, it's a civil defense.
Okay.
So, which is it? And then is that just their way of trying to, I don't know, get the results they want, get more
It's
deportations.
about controlling the nomenclature. I
Yeah.
keep coming back to it's about because specific words have very specific visuals, right? They tee up very specific emotional reactions. And
Yeah.
that's what they say. They're a criminal. Okay, what statute, please?
Yeah.
But see, you don't ask that. And even if you do ask that, the average person is going to go, I don't know if that's a civil statute. I don't know if that's a criminal statute. Well,
Right.
how do I know? Right?
Yeah.
But
Yeah.
the issue is that, though, is that they say that, but it's not always accurate.
Right. Yeah.
Again, it sounds sexier to say they're
Yeah.
criminals because everybody, orange is the new black. What color are they in? Right? They
Yeah.
parade them like that, the hand shackles, the leg shackles, all of that. They do that on purpose because it creates a visceral emotional reaction, right?
Yeah.
But in reality, are they actually criminal? Well, then my question is then, okay, if they're criminal, then I want all the protections under the Constitution for criminal rights. You didn't give me any of those. So are they criminal or are they civil? Do I have the rights or do I not have the rights?
Right. Yeah.
Right? Because when you say they're criminal, but you don't have the rights, well, that's not how that works.
Yeah. Yeah. Is it kind of a, like, I mean, she's standing in front of the press corps and she's the spokesperson. Is it basically just, oh, well, kind of to get that reaction, but then legally there's a lot more down to it, or is there, any translation there, I guess?
I mean, I think the issue is that, I think that the use of these visuals, and back to the raid, that,
Yeah.
they're criminals, they're pouring in, it's an invasion, right?
Yeah.
These are very visceral words, and they conjure up, you don't think about, an invasion as four people walking in a park. That's not the visual you have. Right? You
Right.
have this visual of barbarians at the gate
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
designed to do a very specific job. And so, what they're very good at is the use of those words to create a picture. And even though that is not what reality lines up with, I mean, if you think about it, Biden deported more people than Trump did in his first administration.
Yeah.
Obama deported more people than Trump did in his first administration, right? We don't talk about that because, I mean, quite honestly, the Democrats are very bad at controlling the narrative. And that's the truth. They're not good storytellers. They don't create good visuals. And so this is what you're having. They're talking about all these pits. It's really interesting. There was somebody ran a audio a tape. It was a videotape of people getting on a plane, and they were being deported, right? But when you looked at the date on the tape, it was under Biden. But Biden never used the tape, right? It's a different, and I think in part it's also because I think that for those of us in this space that believe in the rule of law and humanity and social justice, right? We also look at it and say, I don't think it's moral to parade them in handcuffs and leg irons and make them, the walk of shame, so to speak. I find that to be a warrant for a civil violation. They shouldn't be in handcuffs to begin with, right? But the reality of it is I think that moral shield is also what causes the inability to really conjure up some of these visuals and visceral emotions to counter so much of what's being spewed right now.
It is a powerful image, to see that. Whichever side you're on, it's powerful. Once someone is deported, do they have any legal protections? Or, if they're, let's say they were deported to Mexico, is there any way for them to get back in or just fight their deportation?
Maybe. These are very fact-specific things. And so if you have what I call a clean case, and a clean case is someone, let's say, entered on a visa, they stayed here, they get picked up, they get put in removal proceedings, they take not a deportation order, but a voluntary departure, which they is that they agree to leave on their own. This is a very clean case. Okay. And they go back, pick a country wherever they go back. They later have a spouse who is willing to, who's a US citizen or a green card holder. Can they overcome that departure? Yes. Will it happen quickly? No. Okay. There are certain landmines that I like to call baked into the law that you may trip in a variety of different ways. Some of those landmines leave you with a scratch. Some of them blow your leg off. Gosh, the question is, it's very fact specific, and you have to say, okay, what does this look like for this particular individual? So that question's a little bit more difficult to answer, and which is again part of the problem with controlling the narrative is that I don't have a nice, sexy visual to give you. To say, oh yeah, it's all great. They're all going to, end up happily ever after. I can't do that because I'd have to do an in-depth fact analysis of what actually occurred with that person.
That makes sense. It's tricky. Let's see. One question. Let me make sure I covered my initial ones here. Is okay, so with these the targeted enforcement, if that's the word, right? Is there a the current ones, is there a specific ethnic or even economic population that they're arresting or going after?
I think everybody's on. I don't think anybody can be spared right now. I mean, it just isn't. And part of it is that even if, let's say they were doing a targeted operation on someone from Russia, right? But they walk in the room and there's people from El Salvador and China and wherever, right? They're going to take them all. The collaterals is the problem right now.
And there are several sanctuary cities. Los Angeles is one of them, really sort of close to Los Angeles. Do they really have any sort of power to protect the population they're looking for? Or, do they have any legal power, I guess? Or is it just like sort of saying, we're a sanctuary, but then when it comes to it, there's not much they can do.
You know, it's funny, the sanctuary movement and things like that. I think it's really fascinating how this administration in particular speaks out of both sides of its mouth, right? Because on the one hand, on other rights and issues, they want to send everything back to the state, right? Oh, we don't want to send it back to the state. Whether it's healthcare or climate change, whatever, send it back to the state, right? Now, yes, immigration is an issue of under the plenary doctrine that they are, it is reserved for the federal government. Okay. But when Texas wants to use their National Guard to enforce immigration laws, then they say, well, that's okay, right? When they want to use deputize local law enforcement to do ICE arrests. That's okay. Well, which is it? Is it a state issue or is it a federal issue? So if it's a state's issue, then they have the right to say, we're not going to cooperate. But then what you're hearing is, well, but they're now going to punish those people, right? And target those people who say, well, we're not going to let you do it. I mean, that's the rhetoric, which is I'm back to the same thing, which is you'll hear me say that a lot. Which is it going to be? Because they talk out of both sides of the mouth a lot. Is it criminal? Is it civil? Is it a state's right? Is it a federal right? Which is it? Right? And I think they thread the needle in a way that says when it is to their advantage, then this is how we interpret it. When it is to their disadvantage, then this is how we use it to punish. So I think the states are well within their rights to say, look, we're not going to cooperate. Do what you're going to do. And I think, is there going to be litigation? Yes, I think there's going to be litigation. But I mean, look at the DACA kids, right? Classic example of the DACA kids, where the vast majority of Americans want to find a pathway to get their status, right? DACA came down in 2012. Congress has not acted since 2012. Now, remember, Obama passed the DACA program or created the DACA program because they couldn't get comprehensive immigration reform done. And that's true to both sides. We think all the way back to George Bush. George Bush Jr. wanted to have a guest worker program.
That's right.
He wanted to create a guest worker program. I mean, the irony of all of this, if you look at the last true amnesty, the last true amnesty came under Ronald Reagan. That was the
Really?
last true amnesty.
Really?
So people want to say, oh, the Democrats want amnesty. Okay, but here's the deal. The last true amnesty occurred under Ronald Reagan. And what they did at the time is they legalized all of the people who were here undocumented. And they created the I-9 program. That's where it came from. And the role was, is look, people, everybody understood even way back then, that people were coming for a better life and to work, and there was a labor issue in play, right? And so what they did is they say, okay, look, if we legalize who's here and punish the employers for hiring undocumented labor, then that should solve the problem, right? Sounds great, simple solution. We can all get on board with that. So that's what Reagan did. So why did it fail? Why did it fail? It failed because the worker the workforce in America has always been propped up by undocumented low-wage labor,
Yeah.
right? So remember, there was two parts. We legalize everybody, and then we punish the employer. Well, the employer is a business, and they're a U.S. citizen, so they're going to vote.
Right.
We're not ever going to do that.
Yeah.
How many businesses have you ever heard of that are being prosecuted and penalized? Very few, right? So this is the problem. The problem is they had an enforcement tool that they did not use against that entity for which it was designed. So employers continued to use cheap undocumented labor as disposable labor. So if someone who's undocumented knows they can get a job, right? I mean, a $15 job, a $15 an hour job in the United States is still better
That's a lot.
than, right? Because when you
You know.
convert it to pesos or rupees or rubles or whatever you want to convert it to,
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
it still goes further.
I'd say I don't know the numbers, but California agriculture is on the backs of undocumented for sure.
Now, right? People are these raids. We're using raids. Well, people aren't going to work.
Yeah.
Okay, where's the line of people saying, here, I want this job?
Right. Yeah.
Nowhere.
No, it's hard work. It's
It's hard
rough.
work,
Yeah.
right? I mean, and so that's the problem. The problem is it sounds sexier to say, we're doing raids and we're going to throw out all the agricultural workers. Okay, well, go over there and do it. Do the work.
Yeah.
You
Yeah.
know, and you'll see that in every industry. You'll see it in manufacturing. You'll see it in packing plants. You'll see it in agriculture. You'll see it in a variety of different places where, you know, why is Elon Musk now saying we should have more skilled H-1Bs? Well,
Right.
I thought you had American workers who were going to do the job. Why do you need more skilled H-1Bs?
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that's part of the issues is when you think back, and I think I've forgotten your original question here,
No, still interested.
but yeah, when you think of the last true amnesty, that's when it happened. And so George W. Bush did the same thing. He tried to pass a guest worker program because everybody understood it was a labor issue.
Right.
And remember, the Republicans held the House, they held the Senate, they held the presidency.
That's right.
Couldn't get it done.
Couldn't get it done. Yeah.
And it's not couldn't get it done.
Yeah. It's so tricky, you know? It's so tricky. And it seems like it's more than just a major overhaul of the legalities of it in the process. It's like you said, it's a labor issue. It's everything.
I mean, I think it's, and so like if you're looking at listening to some of the conversations that are happening in DC, one of the things they're threatening to do is take away TPS. Okay, well, that's brilliant because temporary protected status comes with work authorization. So you're going to take, I mean, you have to look at the national, what unemployment in the United States is what, 3.7%, 3.5%, something like that. It's
Yeah.
under 4%.
Yeah.
Okay, so now you're going to take that and you're going to take out large batches of people that have legal work authorization. They want to end DACA. Well, okay, so you're going to take all the DACA kids out of the workforce. They want to end TPS. You're going to take all of the TPS workers out of the workforce. They want to end H-4 worker employment authorization. H-4s are derivatives or family members or spouses of someone who's here on H-1B. Remember, H-1B is for labor. Right.
Yeah.
So we need them to do the IT work, but we're going to take their spouse, the labor force. So
Yeah.
who's going to do all of these jobs?
Right. That's true.
We're not asking that question.
Right. Yeah. My husband works in IT. He does like network security. And so I would say 90% of the people he works with are on an H-1B visa. And of course, they brought their families over, right? You wouldn't want to work, and they're here for several years. So you won't want to work here without your family, your wife, and they have children, you know?
Well, you know, the thing of it is that 1B program, I think it's an interesting thing as well, because of the most of the folks from, I mean, 75% of the workers on an H-1B are from India.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Now, when you look at the visa backlogs for India for an immigrant visa, because an H-1B is a non-immigrant visa, does not, but for immigrant visas, you know, they're going to die on the vine, because there's literally a 99-year wait.
Wow.
A 99-year wait.
Really?
They're going to die on the vine.
Yeah.
They are never going to get their green card.
Yeah.
So now here's the thing. With an H-1B, you're tied to a specific employer. Back to, these are labor issues.
Yeah.
And it's until we break the need for for corporate America to rely heavily on foreign labor and treat foreign labor as human beings, as opposed to just disposable labor. Until you can fix that equation, right? You're never going to fix this issue.
Yeah.
You're never going to have the wherewithal. And I say that about both sides.
Right.
I'm literally not even saying one side or the other. I'm saying both sides don't have the wherewithal to fix it, because, I mean, business votes. Non-citizens don't vote. I know they want to say there's all this voter fraud. It's garbage. You know, it's again, just one of those things that they throw out for red meat, but there's no real statistical proof of it.
Yeah.
And so that's the thing is that you have neither side wanting to solve the problem.
Right. Yeah. And here we are. And here we are. Wow. Oh, well, I could talk to you for hours about this. I really appreciate, you know, your knowledge and your work and everything, and for talking to me today, because I've wanted to do a meteor episode on this for a long time, you know, and this is without a doubt timely, you know, right now, but it's not going away either, right? It's going to be in some form. If you've ever read my written work, I do not like to end things neatly because life is messy. Immigration is definitely a topic that will never be neat. And as Reka so eloquently expressed during our interview, neither side really wants to fix it, but it definitely needs reform, major reform. Thank you to Reka Sharma Crawford for so graciously spending her time with me for this interview and for so intelligently explaining a few of the facets of immigration law. If you liked this episode and want to hear more, please subscribe wherever you are listening. I am on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, and I also have a website, thejournalismofeverythingpodcast.com, with bonus material. But if you do anything today, please subscribe.